Chapter 6. For Martin Gibson, the voyage was running smoothly and pleasantly enough. As he always did, he had now managed to organize his surroundings, by which he meant not only his material environment, but also the human beings who shared it with him, to his maximum comfort. He had done a satisfactory amount of writing, some of it quite good, and most of it passable, though he would not get properly into his stride until he had reached Mars. The flight was now entering upon its closing weeks, and there was an inevitable sense of anticlimax and slackening interest, which would last until they entered the orbit of Mars. Nothing would happen until then. For the time being, all the excitements of the voyage were over. The last highlight for Gibson had been the morning when he finally lost the Earth. Day by day it had come closer to the vast, pearly wings of the corona, as though about to immolate all its millions in the funeral pyre of the sun. One evening it had still been visible through the telescope, a tiny spark glittering bravely against the splendor that was soon to overwhelm it. Gibson had thought it might still be visible in the morning, but overnight some colossal explosion had thrown the corona 500,000 kilometers farther into space, and Earth was lost against that incandescent curtain. It would be a week before it reappeared, and by then Gibson's world would have changed more than he would have believed possible in so short a time. If anyone had asked Jimmy Spencer just what he thought of Gibson, that young man would have given rather different replies at various stages of the voyage. At first he had been quite overawed by his distinguished shipmate, but that stage had worn off very quickly. To do Gibson credit, he was completely free from snobbery, and he never made unreasonable use of his privileged position on board the Ares. Thus, from Jimmy's point of view, he was more approachable than the rest of the liner's inhabitants, all of whom were in some degree his superior officers. When Gibson had started taking a serious interest in astronautics, Jimmy had seen him at close quarters once or twice a week, and had made several efforts to weigh him up. This had not been at all easy, for Gibson never seemed to be the same person for very long. There were times when he was considerate and thoughtful and generally good company. Yet there were other occasions when he was so grumpy and morose that he easily qualified as the person on the Ares most to be avoided. What Gibson thought of him, Jimmy wasn't at all sure. He sometimes had an uncomfortable feeling that the author regarded him purely as raw material that might or might not be of value some day. Most people who knew Gibson slightly had that impression, and most of them were right. Yet, as he had tried to pump Jimmy directly, there seemed no real grounds for these suspicions. Another puzzling thing about Gibson was his technical background. When Jimmy had started his evening classes, as everyone called them, he had assumed that Gibson was merely anxious to avoid glaring errors in the material he radioed back to Earth, and had no very deep interest in astronautics for his own sake. It soon became clear that this was far from being the case. Gibson had an almost pathetic anxiety to master quite abstruse branches of the science and to demand mathematical proofs, some of which Jimmy was hard put to provide. The older man must once have had a good deal of technical knowledge, fragments of which still remained with him. How he had acquired it he never explained, nor did he give any reason for his almost obsessive attempts, doomed though they were to repeated failures, to come to grips with scientific ideas far too advanced for him. Gibson's disappointment after these failures was so obvious that Jimmy found himself very sorry for him, except on those occasions when his pupil became bad-tempered and showed a tendency to blame his instructor. Then there would be a brief exchange of discourtesies, Jimmy would pack up his books, and the lesson would not be resumed until Gibson had apologized. Sometimes, on the other hand, Gibson took these setbacks with humorous resignation and simply changed the subject. He would then talk about his experiences in the strange literary jungle in which he lived, a world of weird and often carnivorous beasts whose behavior Jimmy found quite fascinating. Gibson was a good raconteur, with a fine flair for purveying scandal and undermining reputations. He seemed to do this without any malice, and some of the stories he told Jimmy about the distinguished figures of the day quite shocked that somewhat straight-laced youth. The curious fact was that the people whom Gibson so readily dissected often seemed to be his closest friends. This was something that Jimmy found very hard to understand. Yet despite all these warnings, Jimmy talked readily enough when the time came. One of their lessons had grounded on a reef of integral differential equations, and there was nothing to do but abandon ship. Gibson was in one of his amiable moods, and as he closed his books with a sigh, he turned to Jimmy and remarked casually, "You've never told me anything about yourself, Jimmy. What part of England do you come from, anyway?"
"Cambridge. At least, that's where I was born."
"I used to know it quite well 20 years ago."
"But you don't live there now?"
"No. When I was 6, my people moved to Leeds. I've been there ever since."
"What made you take up astronautics?"
"It's rather hard to say. I was always interested in science, and of course spaceflight was the coming thing when I was growing up. So I suppose it was just natural. If I'd been born 50 years before, I guess I'd have gone into aeronautics."
"So you're interested in spaceflight purely as a technical problem and not as, shall we say, something that might revolutionize human thought, open up new planets and all that sort of thing?"
Jimmy grinned.
"I suppose that's true enough. Of course, I am interested in these ideas, but it's the technical side that really fascinates me. Even if there was nothing on the planets, I'd still want to know how to reach them."
Gibson shook his head in mock distress.
"You're going to grow up into one of those cold-blooded scientists who know everything about nothing. Another good man wasted."
"I'm glad you think it will be a waste," said Jimmy with some spirit. "Anyway, why are you so interested in science?"
Gibson laughed, but there was a trace of annoyance in his voice as he replied, "I'm only interested in science as a means, not as an end in itself."
That, Jimmy was sure, was quite untrue, but something warned him not to pursue the matter any further, and before he could reply, Gibson was questioning him again. It was all done in such a friendly spirit of apparently genuine interest that Jimmy couldn't avoid feeling flattered, couldn't help talking freely and easily. Somehow it didn't matter if Gibson was indeed studying him as disinterestedly and clinically as a biologist watching the reactions of one of his laboratory animals. Jimmy felt like talking, and he preferred to give Gibson's motives the benefit of the doubt. He talked of his childhood and early life, and presently Gibson understood the occasional clouds that sometimes seemed to overlie the lad's normally cheerful disposition. It was an old story, one of the oldest. Jimmy's mother had died when he was a little more than a baby, and his father had left him in the charge of a married sister. Jimmy's aunt had been kind to him, but he had never felt at home among his cousins, had always been an outsider. Nor had his father been a great deal of help, for he was seldom in England, and had died when Jimmy was about 10 years old. He appeared to have left very little impression on his son, who, strangely enough, seemed to have clearer memories of the mother whom he could scarcely have known. Once the barriers were down, Jimmy talked without reticence, as if glad to unburden his mind. Sometimes Gibson asked questions to prompt him, but the questions grew further and further apart, and presently came no more.
"I don't think my parents are really very much in love," said Jimmy. "From what Aunt Ellen told me, it was all rather a mistake. There was another man first, but that fell through. My father was the next best thing. Oh, I know this sounds rather heartless, but please remember it all happened such a long time ago, and doesn't mean much to me now."
"I understand," said Gibson quietly, and it seems as if he really did. "Tell me more about your mother."
"Her father, my granddad, that is, was one of the professors at the university. I think mother spent all her life in Cambridge. When she was old enough, she went to college for her degree. She was studying history."
"Oh, all this can't possibly interest you."
"It really does," said Gibson earnestly. "Go on." So Jimmy talked. Everything he told must have been learned from hearsay, but the picture he gave Gibson was surprisingly clear and detailed. His listener guessed that Aunt Helen must have been very talkative, and Jimmy a very attentive small boy. It was one of those innumerable college romances that briefly flower and wither, during that handful of years which seems a microcosm of life itself. But this one had been more serious than most. During her last term, Jimmy's mother, he still hadn't told Gibson her name, had fallen in love with a young engineering student who was halfway through his college career. It had been a whirlwind romance,
and the match was an ideal one, despite the fact that the girl was several years older than the boy. Indeed, it had almost reached the stage of an engagement when Jimmy wasn't quite sure what had happened. The young man had been taken seriously ill, or had had a nervous breakdown, and had never come back to Cambridge.
"My mother never really got over it," said Jimmy with a grave assumption of wisdom, which somehow did not seem completely incongruous. "But another student was very much in love with her, and so she married him. I sometimes feel rather sorry for my father, for he must have known all about the other affair. I never saw much of him because—" "Why, Mr. Gibson, don't you feel well?"
Gibson forced a smile. "It's nothing, just a touch of space sickness. I get it now and then. It will pass in a minute." He only wished that the words were true. All these weeks, in total ignorance and believing himself secure against all the shocks of time and chance, he had been steering a collision course with fate. And now the moment of impact had come. The 20 years that lay behind had vanished like a dream, and he was face to face once more with the ghosts of his own forgotten past.
"There's something wrong with Martin," said Bradley, signing the signals log with a flourish. "It can't be any news he's had from Earth. I've read it all. Do you suppose he's getting homesick?"
"He's left it a little late in the day, if that's the explanation," replied Norden. "After all, we'll be on Mars in a fortnight. But you do rather fancy yourself as an amateur psychologist, don't you?"
"Well, who doesn't?"
"I don't, for one," began Norden pontifically. "Prying into other people's affairs isn't one of my—" An anticipatory gleam in Bradley's eyes warned him just in time, and to the other's evident disappointment, he checked himself in mid-sentence. Martin Gibson, complete with notebook, looking like a cub reporter attending his first press conference, had hurried into the office.
"Well, Owen, what was it you wanted to show me?" he asked eagerly.
Bradley moved to the main communication rack.
"It isn't really very impressive," he said, "but it means that we've passed another milestone, and always gives me a bit of a kick. Listen to this."
He pressed the speaker switch and slowly brought up the volume control. The room was flooded with the hiss and crackle of radio noise, like the sound of 1,000 frying pans at the point of imminent ignition. It was a sound that Gibson had heard often enough in the signals cabin, and, for all its unvarying monotony, it never failed to fill him with a sense of wonder. He was listening, he knew, to the voices of the stars and nebulae, to radiations that had set out upon their journey before the birth of man. And buried far down in the depths of that crackling, whispering chaos, there might be, there must be, the sounds of alien civilizations talking to one another in the deeps of space. But alas, their voices were lost beyond recall in the welter of cosmic interference which nature herself had made. This, however, was certainly not what Bradley had called him to hear. Very delicately, the signals officer made some vernier adjustments, frowning a little as he did so.
"I had it on the nose a minute ago. Hope it hasn't drifted off. Ah! Here it is."
At first Gibson could detect no alteration in the barrage of noise. Then he noticed that Bradley was silently marking time with his hand, rather quickly, at the rate of some 2 beats every second. With this to guide him, Gibson presently detected the infinitely faint undulating whistle that was breaking through the cosmic storm.
"What is it?" he asked, already half-guessing the answer.
"It's the radio beacon on Deimos. There's one on Phobos as well, but it's not so powerful, and we can't pick it up yet. When we get nearer Mars, we'll be able to fix ourselves within a few hundred kilometers by using them. We're at 10 times the usable range now, but it's nice to know."
Yes, thought Gibson, it is nice to know. Of course, these radio aids weren't essential when one could see one's destination all the time, but they simplified some of the navigational problems. As he listened with half-closed eyes to that faint pulsing, sometimes almost drowned by the cosmic barrage, he knew how the mariners of old must have felt when they caught the first glimpse of the harbor lights from far out at sea.
"I think that's enough," said Bradley, switching off the speaker and restoring silence. "Anyway, it should give you something new to write about. Things have been pretty quiet lately, haven't they?"
He was watching Gibson intently as he said this, but the author never responded. He merely jotted a few words in his notebook, thanked Bradley with absent-minded and unaccustomed politeness, and departed to his cabin.
"You're quite right," said Norden when he had gone. "Something certainly happened to Martin. I'd better have a word with Doc."
"I shouldn't bother," replied Bradley. "Whatever it is, I don't think it's anything you can handle with pills. Better leave Martin to work it out his own way."
"Maybe you're right," said Norden grudgingly, "but I hope he doesn't take too long over it."
He had now taken almost a week. The initial shock of discovering that Jimmy Spencer was Kathleen Morgan's son had already worn off, but the secondary effects were beginning to make themselves felt. Among these was a feeling of resentment that anything like this should have happened to him. It was such an outrageous violation of the laws of probability, the sort of thing that would never have happened in one of Gibson's own novels. But life was so inartistic, and there was really nothing one could do about it. This mood of childish petulance was now passing, to be replaced by a deeper sense of discomfort. All the emotions he had thought safely buried beneath 20 years of feverish activity were now rising to the surface again, like deep-sea creatures slain in some submarine eruption. On Earth, he could have escaped by losing himself once more in the crowd, but here he was trapped, with nowhere to flee. It was useless to pretend that nothing had really changed, to say, "Of course I knew that Kathleen and Gerald had a son. What difference does that make now?" It made a great deal of difference. Every time he saw Jimmy, he would be reminded of the past and, what was worse, of the future that might have been. The most urgent problem now was to face the facts squarely and to come to grips with the new situation. Gibson knew well enough that there was only one way in which this could be done, and the opportunity would arise soon enough. Jimmy had been down to the southern hemisphere and was making his way along the equatorial observation deck when he saw Gibson sitting at one of the windows, staring out into space. For a moment he thought the other had not seen him and had decided not to intrude upon his thoughts when Gibson called out, "Hello, Jimmy. Have you got a moment to spare?" As it happened, Jimmy was rather busy, but he knew that there had been something wrong with Gibson and realized that the older man needed his presence. So he came and sat on the bench recessed into the observation port, and presently he knew as much of the truth as Gibson thought good for either of them.
"I'm going to tell you something, Jimmy," Gibson began, "which is known to only a handful of people. Don't interrupt me and don't ask any questions, not until I've finished, at any rate. When I was rather younger than you, I wanted to be an engineer. I was quite a bright kid in those days and had no difficulty in getting into college through the usual examinations. As I wasn't sure what I intended to do, I took the 5-year course in general engineering physics, which was quite a new thing in those days. In my first year, I did fairly well, well enough to encourage me to work harder next time. In my second year, I did, not brilliantly, but a lot better than average. And in the third year, I fell in love. It wasn't exactly for the first time, but I knew it was the real thing at last. Now, falling in love while you're at college may or may not be a good thing for you. It all depends on circumstances. If it's only a mild flirtation, it probably doesn't matter one way or the other. But if it's really serious, there are two possibilities. It may act as a stimulus. It may make you determined to do your best, to show that you're better than the other fellows. On the other hand, you may get so emotionally involved in the affair that nothing else seems to matter, and your studies will go to pieces. That is what happened in my case." Gibson fell into a brooding silence, and Jimmy stole a glance at him as he sat in the darkness a few feet away. They were on the night side of the ship, and the corridor lights had been dimmed so that the stars could be seen in their unchallenged glory. The constellation of Leo was directly ahead, and there in its heart was the brilliant ruby gem that was their goal. Next to the sun itself, Mars was by far the brightest of all celestial bodies, and already its disk was just visible to the naked eye.
the brilliant crimson light playing full on his face gave Gibson a healthy, even a cheerful appearance, quite out of keeping with his feelings. Was it true, Gibson wondered, that one never really forgot anything? It seemed now as if it might be. He could still see, as clearly as he had 20 years ago, that message pinned on the faculty notice board. The Dean of Engineering wishes to see M. Gibson in his office at 3 o'clock. He had had to wait, of course, until 3:15, and that hadn't helped. Nor would it have been so bad if the dean had been sarcastic or icily aloof, or even if he had lost his temper. Gibson could still picture that inhumanly tidy room with its neat files and careful rows of books, could remember the dean's secretary padding away on her typewriter in the corner, pretending not to listen. Perhaps, now he came to think of it, she wasn't pretending after all. The experience wouldn't have been so novel to her as it was to him. Gibson had liked and respected the dean for all the old man's finicky ways and meticulous pedantry, and now he had let him down, which made his failure doubly hard to bear. The dean had rubbed it in with his more-in-sorrow-than-in-anger technique, which had been more effective than he knew or intended. He had given Gibson another chance, but he was never to take it. What made matters worse, though he was ashamed to admit the fact, was that Kathleen had done fairly well in her own exams. When his results had been published, Gibson had avoided her for several days, and when they met again, he had already identified her as the cause of his failure. He could see this so clearly now that it no longer hurt. Had he really been in love if he was prepared to sacrifice Kathleen for the sake of his own self-respect? For that is what it came to. He had tried to shift the blame onto her. The rest was inevitable. That quarrel on their last long cycle ride together into the country, and their returns by separate routes. The letters that hadn't been opened, above all, the letters that hadn't been written. Their unsuccessful attempt to meet, if only to say goodbye, on his last day in Cambridge. But even this had fallen through. The message hadn't reached Kathleen in time, and though he had waited until the last minute, she had never come. The crowded train, packed with cheering students, had drawn noisily out of the station, leaving Cambridge and Kathleen behind. He had never seen either again. There was no need to tell Jemmy about the dark months that had followed. He need never know what was meant by the simple words, "I had a breakdown and was advised not to return to college." Dr. Evans had made a pretty good job of patching him up, and he'd always be grateful for that. It was Evans who'd persuaded him to take up writing during his convalescence, with results that had surprised them both. How many people knew that his first novel had been dedicated to his psychoanalyst? Well, if Rachmaninoff could do the same thing with the C minor concerto, why shouldn't he? Evans had given him a new personality and a vocation through which he could win back his self-confidence. But he couldn't restore the future that had been lost. All his life, Gibson would envy the men who had finished what he had only begun, the men who could put after their names the degrees and qualifications he would never possess, and who would find their life's work in fields of which he could be only a spectator. If the trouble had lain no deeper than this, it might not have mattered greatly. But in salvaging his pride by throwing the blame onto Kathleen, he had warped his whole life. She, and through her all women, had become identified with failure and disgrace. Apart from a few attachments which had not been taken very seriously by either partner, Gibson had never fallen in love again, and now he realized that he never would. Knowing the cause of his complaint had helped him not in the least to find a cure. None of these things, of course, need be mentioned to Jimmy. It was sufficient to give the bare facts and to leave Jimmy to guess what he could. One day, perhaps, he might tell him more, but that depended on many things. When Gibson had finished, he was surprised to find how nervously he was waiting for Jimmy's reactions. He felt himself wondering if the boy had read between the lines and apportioned blame where it was due, whether he would be sympathetic, angry, or merely embarrassed. It had suddenly become of the utmost importance to win Jimmy's respect and friendship, more important than anything that had happened to Gibson for a very long time. Only thus could he satisfy his conscience and quieten those accusing voices from the past. He could not see Jimmy's face, for the other was in shadow, and it seemed an age before he broke the silence. "Why have you told me this?" he asked quietly. His voice was completely neutral, free both from sympathy or reproach. Gibson hesitated before answering. The pause was natural enough, for, even to himself, he could hardly have explained all his motives. "I just had to tell you," he said earnestly. "I couldn't have been happy until I'd done so. And besides, I felt I might be able to help somehow." Again that nerve-wracking silence. Then Jimmy rose slowly to his feet. "I'll have to think about what you've told me," he said, his voice still almost emotionless. "I don't know what to say now." Then he was gone. He left Gibson in a state of extreme uncertainty and confusion, wondering whether he had made a fool of himself or not. Jimmy's self-control, his failure to react, had thrown him off balance and left him completely at a loss. Only of one thing was he certain. In telling the facts, he had already done a great deal to relieve his mind. But there was still much that he had not told Jimmy. Indeed, there was still much that he did not know himself.